Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we'll get local reaction to Roseanne Barr's racist tweets and ABC's decision to cancel her show. Also today, Carl Zimmer on why most of us misunderstand the concept of heredity and how science is rapidly changing the basic meaning of biological inheritance.
But to actually see yourself, in a sense, in a molecular way, is pretty mind-blowing.
Plus, the Worcester Art Museum installs new permanent signs telling visitors which people in early American portraits benefited from slavery.
She created labels to intervene and to bring attention and a voice to those invisible people behind these sitters.
And is this hockey or Game of Thrones?
The Golden Knight's army has vanquished the kings.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Well, Roseanne Barr has reached the denial stage in her reaction to losing her show yesterday. Just a little over a half hour ago, Barr tweeted, quote, "I am not a racist, I never was, and I never will be. One stupid joke in a lifetime of fighting for civil rights for all minorities against network studios at the expense of my nervous system family wealth will never be taken from me," end quote. Fact check. Over the course of her lifetime, there's been more than one such joke. Remember the time Barr called the Boston Marathon bombing a false flag operation designed to remove the Second Amendment? That was November 2013. Meanwhile, at the White House today, Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said no one's defending Barr's racist tweets. True, because President Donald Trump instead earlier today tweeted asking for an apology from Disney President Bob Iger, saying, quote, "Gee, he never called President Donald J. Trump to apologize for the horrible statements made and said about me on ABC. Maybe I just didn't get the call," end quote. Oh, and Sanofi US, makers of Ambien, said today, quote, that racism is not a known side effect of its drug, contrary to what Barr claimed yesterday. That is the roundup, and I know it'll probably be out of date by the time our show re-airs at 10 o'clock tonight, but hey, let's dive in anyway. And joining me now to wrestle with the second-day ramifications of ABC's decision to cancel Roseanne Barr's show is Catherine Van Arendonk from Morristown, New Jersey. She is a contributing writer at Vulture. Catherine, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Renee, good to have you back.
Good to be back, Meghna.
Okay, so I haven't talked to you, Renee, since all this happened just yesterday. But what was your first reaction when ABC pulled the plug on Barr's show?
Well, I thought it was they did the right thing, certainly. What I found a little disconcerting was how ABC officials were getting all this praise in social media, given the fact that they were the people who put her on in the first place. And it just made me feel like, you know, that somehow we're supposed to praise people for putting out a fire that they started. So, you know, I don't know that they really had a choice, but I think that they were reacting to the backlash that was pretty instant when people saw that tweet, and less the tweet itself.
I mean, did they start the fire, or they simply knew that it was always burning there on social media and just went ahead and put the show on the air anyway?
I think they liked the fact that, you know, they could get controversy with Roseanne, and controversy can translate into ratings. And they knew. I mean, CNN said earlier today that there were, you know, three or four other occasions when her tweets presented problems for ABC, but they still kept her on. So, you know, it's always important to reiterate that this was not a one-off. This was not one racist tweet. This was the latest racist tweet.
Right. So, Catherine, to that point, tell me a little bit more about what you think, because, I mean, ABC's statement yesterday said that Roseanne's tweet did not comport with their values as a company. But to Renee's point, I mean, it wasn't the first time she's done something like this. So what was different, if anything, about what Barr tweeted yesterday?
Yeah, Renee's exactly right. There is nothing at all different about what Roseanne Barr tweeted yesterday. She has been tweeting equally racist and damaging conspiracy theories also for the entire run of the show and before. ABC knew exactly what they were getting when they put her on the air. What changed is that slowly they started to feel like there was enough backlash to who Barr was. And potentially to some other problems that the network, some other issues that the network has had with not airing, for instance, a Black-ish episode that was about kneeling and NFL protests. And so that has played into their calculus, and I think at some point finally they decided that enough was enough.
Yeah. You know, I am seeing here that I'm just trying to be sure I find the right thing. Well, you know, it's all going by so fast. Forget it. I'm not even going to try to keep up with it. Renee, so tell me a little bit more. I mean, what I want to understand or try to figure out, I guess, is that if the backlash was, should ABC have done something sooner? I mean, I guess what you were saying earlier is that you don't think they ever should have put the show on the air to begin with.
Well, exactly. It's not a matter of taking it off now. It's the question of why it was on to begin with. You know, back in 2013, when she was making, sort of spreading those conspiracy theories about the Boston Marathon bombing, she also called UN Ambassador Susan Rice an ape. Mm-hmm. Now, that's exactly what she called Valerie Jarrett in the last few days, and there was a bigger reaction. ABC knew this. They knew exactly who they were getting, and to them it was worth the risk. And even if it meant that there would be the occasional racist tweet or conspiracy theory to contend with, they were in it for the ratings. So, you know, again, I don't want to give ABC – ABC should have taken the show off – but the question is, should the show have ever been on to begin with?
Yeah. So Catherine, the thing that I was looking for, and Renee, sorry, because I was like just in the middle of trying to find my notes here, but Matthew Gilbert in The Globe today pointed out that it was just back in March of this year, I guess, when Ben Sherwood, president of Disney ABC Television Group, told The New York Times, "You can't control Roseanne Barr. Many who have tried failed. She's the one and only." So that speaks to Renee's point. I mean, they fully knew that there was this toxic stew going on in Roseanne Barr's social media life. So why did they persist to the point where, you know, they were waiting for the pushback to get as big as it did?
Yeah, I think I can understand, although I completely agree that given Roseanne's totally demonstrable racism, they should not have put the show on the air in the first place. I can understand the appeal and the desire to put on a revival of the original Roseanne if you could also have had the original Roseanne Barr before she had access to Twitter and before these were parts of her personality. I think it is interesting to see that it has in this sort of taken this long for the tide to turn against it, but it has seemed as though this were going to happen to the show anyhow. It lost one of its major creative forces, Whitney Cummings, one of the people who was really behind bringing it back. She announced last week that she was going to be leaving and was not going to be involved in producing the show anymore. And Wanda Sykes obviously tweeted before it was canceled yesterday that she was no longer going to be a consulting producer on it either. So it does feel like ABC was making a decision, but they were probably canceling a show that was going to be very creatively fraught anyhow.
Yeah. Renee, what do you think about that? Because that's something that we at Radio Boston here have been kind of talking about all day, that, you know, it's hard to remember in the midst of this current maelstrom, but the original Roseanne show from all those many years ago was really a brave voice and truly a breakthrough program back then. And it seems as if I'm seeing reports here that even those original nine seasons now have been pulled from syndication. So is that justified?
You know, I think right now Roseanne Barr is completely toxic and nobody wants to be associated with her, whether it was with the reboot or the original show. You know, the original Roseanne was a bright spot for a lot of people. It spoke very directly into their lives. I think to some degree that's what ABC wanted, but they also wanted this new Roseanne Barr grafted onto Roseanne Connor, you know, with, you know, more radical, more right-wing views, and because they felt they were trying to make a show for a particular audience. You know, which is offensive in and of itself. I didn't know that TV shows needed to be made for people to support people's political views.
Well, so I'm looking here at an opinion piece posted on Fox News today, and the headline is that ABC doesn't hate Roseanne, the network hates her viewers. And Todd Starnes here is making the argument, why pull the plug on the show entirely? I mean, if ABC owns the content of the series, why not just write Roseanne out of it? That by canceling the show in its entirety, they are denying her all the people who, you know, whether or not they were fans of her, but people who were fans of the show, an opportunity to watch something they loved.
Yeah, there are going to be plenty of things for people who are Trump fans to watch come in the fall. Fox has picked up Last Man Standing, which is a revival of a show where Tim Allen plays a very explicit Trump supporter. He talks about it constantly in that original series. I am sure it will be that way again. There is also already some rumbling that there may be a new fall show or sometime next year with the whole cast of Roseanne, except for Roseanne. Obviously, there's no way to know what that show is going to be yet. But I am not at all worried that there's going to be a dearth of things for Trump viewers to watch and see their views reflected. The question is, you know, does it have to be Roseanne? Obviously, I'm glad that it's not going to be.
Yeah. Renee, what do you think about that?
I mean, I think if the feeling is that you need more economic diversity on TV among the TV characters, then you have a show like the reboot of One Day at a Time on Netflix, which has a Latino family, you know, very much a working class family. You know, these shows do exist, and there's a way to have these shows on without people attached to them who are offending, you know, who are saying racist and incendiary things because that's who they are. And again, that's part of what they wanted on the show, because that's who Roseanne is playing on the show somewhat. She can't say on the show what she said in her tweets. But, you know, when you join the character and the actor that closely, you can't really have one without the other.
Mm. Catherine, I'm curious what you think about this. I mean, so Channing Dungey is the president of ABC Entertainment. She's the one who put out the statement yesterday that they were going to cancel, that they canceled Roseanne Barr's show. Or the Roseanne show. I mean, she's a woman of color. Mm-hmm. Do you think that ABC would have made this decision without Channing Dungey at the helm?
You know, I can't say. I don't want to speculate about what her feeling has been for the past several years about watching what's been going on with ABC programming. She was also at the helm when they greenlit the show. I mean, famously, the morning after the election, ABC had a meeting of its executives where they talked about how they could make new shows that would be more directly appealing to a Trump voter. They used a different, they called it Middle America, but that's sort of what they meant. And Dungey was involved at that point as well. So, you know, I'm not sure.
Well, back in March, she told the New York Times, this is Channing Dungey telling the Times, we had spent a lot of time looking for diverse voices in terms of people of color and people from different religions and even people with different perspectives on gender, but we had not been thinking nearly enough about economic diversity and some of the other cultural divisions within our own country.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. On the other hand, you know, they do have a show. They have Speechless. They have Fresh Off the Boat. They have some other shows that are about families that are not wealthy families, that do not live in coastal urban areas. And there are other shows on network TV that represent different perspectives, different economic levels as well. One of my favorites is NBC's Superstore, which is about a bunch of employees who work at a fictional version of like a Walmart. So they do exist, but I can completely understand this sense that, you know, we need to expand what network programming looks like so that it doesn't just look like people who live in New York.
Renee Graham, last question goes to you. I mean, how firm should networks be in their decision to cancel or rebuke, you know, actors, people, voices that work with them? And because I'm thinking, again, this is the pushback from some of Roseanne Barr's supporters is, you know, Joy Reid is still on MSNBC. Joy Behar hasn't been, you know, taken off the air. They're seeing what they believe is a double standard, that they might abhor what Roseanne Barr said, but she gets her show canceled, whereas other people get to stay on the air.
I think every case is different. I think with Roseanne, it's the cumulative effect that this was not a one-off. Perhaps if she had said this and, you know, in sort of anger or whatever her mood might have been, and it was the only indication that these were her feelings, you know, she might have survived this. Maybe. Social media isn't, you know, social media is kind of built to grind people down when something like this happens. But because she has a history of this, I just think ABC got to a point where they felt like they simply couldn't take the chance of a boycott and advertisers and all the things that come into play when you have a television show on. So, you know, yeah, I suppose if, you know, there had been enough of an upcry or outcry at MSNBC about Joy Reid's homophobic comments that she made in a blog years ago, then perhaps MSNBC might have had to react differently. But, you know, we have what we have with Roseanne. And again, I defy anyone to argue that it's more important to have her on the show than to take a stand against what she said.
Well, Renee Graham is columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Renee, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And Catherine Van Arendonk, contributing writer on television at Vulture, speaking to us from Morristown, New Jersey. Catherine, it was great to have you. Thank you as well.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, let's visit a doctor's office now for a serious and difficult discussion that starts off like a regular medical checkup. Dr. Rebecca Lee pauses for a minute and holds her patient's gaze.
Today, Stacey, I wanted to take a minute to kind of hit the pause button and see where you're at, what you are thinking about your illness, and what your goals are.
Goals for the last stage of life. This patient is not yet at that stage, but she does have a serious illness, and Dr. Lee wants to document her patient's preferences before there's a crisis moment in an emergency room or an ICU.
You know, I like to do that when folks are actually feeling well. Do you feel comfortable with that?
Yeah.
Now, such conversations with a primary care doctor are rare. Planning for the end of life ahead of time is part of a North Shore pilot project designed to help patients spend their last days the way they want, while also saving millions of dollars in medical expenses. WBUR's Martha Biebinger picks up the conversation in Dr. Lee's exam room in Danvers.
Stacey Regal O'Hare, 52, inherited a rare disease called von Hippel-Lindau syndrome that can produce tumors, benign and cancerous, all over the body.
It can be dormant or it can be on fire, and right now I'm kind of in between.
But Regal O'Hare is having trouble with some daily activities.
I need help with a lot of physical stuff. I can't really cook anymore, because I keep burning myself.
Regal O'Hare has lost feeling in her hands. A finger might slip off a potholder onto a hot skillet, and Regal O'Hare won't notice it until she sees the skin blister. Dr. Lee offers a box of tissues.
You're amazing.
Thanks.
Dr. Lee glances down at questions on a cue card she received during a recent training for primary care physicians about how to have these difficult conversations with patients.
If you're health situation were to get worse, what are your goals? What would be your wishes around that?
I would not want to be non-function. Like, I don't even know how to express that. Like, I don't want to be on a vent and just hear.
Vent as in ventilator, if Regal O'Hare becomes unable to breathe on her own. The conversation continues for another 20 minutes. Dr. Lee takes notes that anyone who checks the medical record will see. Helping patients with a serious illness plan ahead is one element of a grant-funded partnership between the North Shore Physicians Group and Care Dimensions, a nonprofit that offers hospice and palliative care. Regal O'Hare does not need hospice, but Dr. Lee wonders if she'd be interested in palliative care to help, for example, with pain management or nutrition counseling or stress at home.
I think with further investigation.
Yeah.
I would, yes, yes.
That yes means Regal O'Hare will get a call soon from Eileen Fagan, a nurse practitioner who will begin to figure out what Regal O'Hare needs.
Such as handicap parking, more care at home, someone to help with grocery delivery. So it's about restoring the freedom to be comfortable, not think about your illness, and carry on.
Patients who have heart or breathing problems are asked to log vital signs daily on a tablet-style device. A nurse reviews the numbers, looking for early warnings. Susan Lysett-Hurley is the project's program director.
If their weight is going up, that means they're probably holding fluid. Are they now also having trouble breathing? And putting that all together, they can make a call to the primary care and maybe adjust their medications before it gets too late, and then they would need emergency department visit.
And that's where the project is expected to save money. Emergency room visits and readmissions after hospitalizations are both down based on the first few months of data. With those two changes, the $750,000 project grant from the state's Health Policy Commission is expected to save $7.2 million. That nearly tenfold return on investment has big implications. 25% of Medicare dollars are spent during the last year of patients' lives. Dr. Don Berwick is a member of the Health Policy Commission.
The promise here is that if we actually do what matters to people, their lives and their deaths are more under their control, they're better for them, and costs fall.
But Berwick points out a problem. The insurer gets the savings. Even in this case, where patients are part of what's supposed to be an innovative healthcare spending model called an ACO, there's no way for North Shore doctors and nurses to use money they did not spend to sustain the project.
So we're going to have to think hard about the American healthcare payment system to allow programs like this to really thrive.
How to sustain projects like this one is a debate unfolding across the country. This program runs through November.
That report from WBUR's Martha Biebinger. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We often think about heredity as pieces of our own personal puzzle. She has her mother's laugh, he has his father's eyes, you know, small components of our parents and ancestors that help make up who we are as individuals. But puzzles are funny things. You know, they're made up of pieces with regular fixed patterns that then form a somewhat predictable final image. But according to New York Times science columnist and author Carl Zimmer, heredity isn't a rudimentary puzzle. In fact, it's dynamic, subject to many forces, both biological and environmental. And he writes about it in his new book. It's called She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity. And it looks at the history of heredity, the science of inheritance as it stands now, and where it might go. And Carl Zimmer joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I use that puzzle analogy there. Is it a fair one that heredity isn't as simple as interlocking pieces of a puzzle?
Heredity is something we're all fascinated with, and it's something that I think we all think we know. But the closer you look at it, the more you realize it's incredibly mysterious and turns your assumptions upside down left and right.
Okay, well, so let's start with some of the basics. That the, you know, sort of the common understanding that I get half of my genes from my mom or the male side, half of the genes from the female side, and it comes down through the family tree, et cetera. I mean, is that, that's factually correct, but what's wrong about that in understanding heredity?
Oh, no, that's a great place to start. Yeah. You know, I mean, high school genetics is a fantastic place to get started. But, you know, how is it that 50% of your DNA you get from your parents, your mother, and 50% from your father make you look kind of like them in some ways and not in others? You know, why is it that you might look a lot like your great-grandparent? You know, I'm tall and my brother is tall. My parents are not. And so we're always saying, like, well, where'd you get that from? You know, mm-hmm. as if there's some like sort of magical height token that gets passed along the generations, then pops up. And when you actually look at what scientists are learning about how heredity flows down through the generations, it's fascinating in just how complex it goes. It's like a river that's weaving around in and of itself.
Okay, but it's still genetically determined, right? It's just, is it the expression of some of those traits kind of pop up under certain circumstances? Or?
Well, you know, the genes are certainly part of the story of how you are, how you turned out. I mean, part of it is also, you know, what environment are those genes in? So you might have genes that might make you taller than average under certain circumstances, but if, you know, you're growing up without enough nutrition, you're never going to see that. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that all over the world, everyone is several inches taller now than they were 100 years ago. It's not because they inherited super tall genes. It's just because life got better.
Right. I mean, not to make this about me, but both my parents, they're immigrants from India. They grew up very poor in India. My dad, love him. He's 5 foot. Five, I think. My mom is 5'1" when she's standing straight up. And my family, their kids and all my cousins were all significantly taller than my parents. And I asked my dad about this one day years ago, why he thinks that is. And he looked at me straight in the eye. He's like, medical care and not having, the first 10 years of your life be a struggle with constant, amoebic dysentery for example.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that's totally true. It's totally true.
OK, but so then, if we take into account the import of these environmental factors that can influence the expression of genes. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's a big
okay,
part of it.
So, but I also read that you said that you're saying that, for example, if we go back up a family tree to any one of our ancestors, that maybe there's a 50-50 chance that we may not actually share any genetic material from them?
The further back you go, the more ancestors you have. So if you go, say, about 10 generations back, you have over 1,000 ancestors. The problem is, in terms of genes, is that you're only inheriting, one copy of each gene from each parent. And so you repeat that over many generations. And after a while, some ancestors won't be leaving any DNA in a descendant at all. So actually, scientists have done some math on this, and they estimate about half of your ancestors, 10 generations back, you have no genetic connection to at all. They're still your ancestors, but you have no genetic link to them. So, we tend to look at, say that, ancestry and kinship are exactly equal to genes. And they're not. It's more complicated than that.
So tell me more. What would you say? If it is more complicated than that, are you saying that we should be considering ancestry as culture and history as well?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you are definitely a part of history. Whether or not you have genetic connection to people in the past is another question mm-hmm. altogether. So I think, we should think of ourselves as inheriting culture and inheriting history, along with inheriting some genes. We need a bigger, broader definition of heredity to really appreciate how we got to where we are.
Yeah. So, but then the power, maybe the cultural power of trying to trace ancestry and proving genetic links to certain people, whatever, is very, very strong. I mean, just look
Huge.
At the whole, the enormous business around taking a cheek swab and sending it off in the mail and finding out who you might be related to. Why do you think it has such power?
I think because we have come to basically equate genes with ancestry, and we think that we are going to discover who we are in some ultimate sense by taking a cheek swab. And the numbers are incredible. Ancestry.com alone has 10 million customers. 23andMe has 5 million. And most of that growth was in the last year. So this is incredibly explosive. And it's exciting that lots of people are going to be getting to look at their own DNA. This is the first time in history this has ever been possible. But, when people look at that, I want to encourage people to sort of think more broadly about what they're looking at. I mean, if you 23andMe tells you you're 2% Neanderthal, what does that mean? Is that different than being 1% Neanderthal? Really? You have to really ask yourself, what are these numbers actually telling you? Because it can be tricky. You can get the wrong impression.
Mm. Now, you sequenced your own genome.
Yeah, I went sort of beyond the 23andMe kind of thing, and I actually got my whole genome, every single genetic letter sequenced, and took it, the raw data, to scientists and said, help me, what does this mean? And it was a fascinating experience. I talk about it in the book.
Well, so tell me a little bit more. First of all, what was it like to, I mean, did it come, this is such a rudimentary question, forgive me, but did it come back to you in the form of, that barcode-y looking thing of, your DNA, or was it ATCGs? What was it when you got your genome sequence?
Well, it showed up as an external hard drive, so a little metal box.
Okay, it was a hard drive. Okay.
And on it was basically the spreadsheet from hell, basically billions of rows, each with a little bit of genetic sequence in it. And then I would go to scientists, and they would help show me how they piece it together to show me what my actual sequence was. And then we take the next step and say, okay, so what did you inherit?
What did you find out?
Well, one interesting thing is that I inherited a gene from one of my parents. I don't know which, but thank you, because it's a protective gene. We always think of these mutations as being dangerous and harmful, but there are some that are actually very beneficial. So I, it turns out, have one that actually gives me a strong protection against certain autoimmune diseases. And as I was looking into this more, having discovered this, it turned out that drug companies have been using that knowledge about that mutation to develop a drug to treat autoimmune diseases. There's that connection there that I have from, you know, my own genes to drug discovery, which was really cool. And then also, I think, you know, it was very interesting to go to a researcher who studies Neanderthals and for him to basically give me a catalog of my Neanderthal genes. So, you know, I'm about 1.2% Neanderthal, which is typical. But to actually, like, see which genes I happen to have from Neanderthals, inheriting them after 60, 70,000 years, was very cool.
Now, since you mentioned Neanderthals, are any of those genes expressing themselves? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Neanderthal genes still express themselves.
Yes, and in you too, yeah. I mean, basically, Neanderthals interbred with humans when humans expanded out of Africa. So basically, anybody who has ancestry outside of Africa has roughly 1% Neanderthal DNA. So yeah. You've got some.
Wow. That's great. I mean, so that's a form of inheritance as well.
Absolutely.
You know, before I get, we should definitely talk about sort of the road ahead here, which is vitally important. But I don't want to skip over the fact that, I mean, because you go through the history of how societies and cultures have engaged with our emerging knowledge of genetic inheritance and heredity and how frequently it's been used for very darker purposes, you know, eugenics, the Nazis' idea of a superior race. A lot of the quote-unquote science that was done in the United States in the 19th century around eugenics, for example. I mean, why has science repeatedly gone in that direction as well?
Well,
it's been used in that direction, I should say.
It has been. Yeah. And I think that, you know, scientists are working in societies and they are products of that society. And so you scientists may come into their research with a lot of assumptions. And so, you know, there a number of, you know, white American scientists around 1900 went into their, you know, discovered genetics with an assumption that they were superior. The whites were superior. So genetics was going to show them that. Many of them believed that, you know, genes would explain things that they kind of felt that they already knew, that, for example, intelligence was entirely inherited. And so, you know, feeble-mindedness must be entirely genetic as well. And so they looked for the answers that they wanted to find.
Yeah. So moving forward now, we're in the era of potential gene editing, right? Or I shouldn't even say potential. Like, it's a developed science now.
It's happening right here in Boston.
And, you know, CRISPR, we've talked about that on this show a lot. It makes me wonder, does that mean that the entire notion of heredity or genetic inheritance is soon going to be in moot?
Well, the thing is that, you know, heredity is not something that follows certain laws like the law of gravity or something like that. I mean, heredity is just, as we know, it's just something that evolved, and it's different from species to species, and it can be manipulated. And that's just a fact. And so, yes, it is possible for us now to step into the DNA of a plant or an animal and change the genes, and then they'll pass that down. There are other ways in which we can override sort of regular heredity. You know, it will probably become possible soon for people to take a cheek scraping and convert those cells into eggs or sperm.
Just from a cheek scraping.
Yeah. You turn them back into stem cells and then you turn them into eggs or sperm. And it might even be possible, say, for a man to generate eggs and sperm just from his own cells and then fertilize that. And then you have an embryo. And then you take a cell out of that embryo and make more eggs and sperm and then fertilize them. And what do you have? And what would you call that? It's sort of beyond the language of heredity that we're accustomed to. But these things are becoming conceivable as stem cells and CRISPR come online.
I mean, it's such a cliche, but Brave New World is what I would call it at the very least. Not that it's all negative, but it does introduce a raft of ethical, societal concerns that we need to be grappling with.
And I don't think we're talking about it anywhere near enough. We just sort of talk about science fiction a bit and then kind of move on. But these things are going to be happening potentially happening very soon? And is it going to be something that governments are going to get involved in? Is it okay to let the marketplace drive these decisions, just leave it up to parents? Is it okay for parents to basically enhance their IVF child? We have to decide.
Yeah. But I mean, I don't want to fall into the trap, which I could, of being very doom and gloom about the whole thing. Because, I mean, you also write about how with this same technology and these possibilities, we could enter a future where there are no hereditary diseases whatsoever. Could we?
Well, conceivably, if you had a huge global campaign and you basically forced everybody to do IVF and that sort of thing, yeah, maybe you could do that. It seems a little far-fetched to me. And honestly, I think we also have big issues to think about that I would argue are other kinds of heredity. You know, we have inherited a planet that's very altered from before, you know, our species started putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the Industrial Revolution. And we're going to pass down that planet to future generations. That's a kind of cultural heredity. And I think we should think about intervening there as well to basically make sure that this planet is livable. Yeah. So, you know, when we talk about things like, you know, what's going to happen with CRISPR, I think we have to balance it with the other issues that the future faces.
How far could we take this, though, with CRISPR and gene editing? Because, again, I can't tell if the question I'm about to ask is just utterly ridiculous. But, you know, part of the magic, quote-unquote magic of evolution comes through that random assortment of genes that you don't really fully know what you're going to get when you cross, whether it be runner beans or people. But if we can control genomic material through gene editing to an incredibly fine point, I mean, are we potentially messing with evolution?
I don't think so, okay. Simply because there are 7 billion people on Earth. There are hundreds of millions of kids born all the time. And you just have to imagine, again, every single kid being produced out of a lab. And I don't see that happening anytime soon. So I think that, you know, humanity is going to continue to produce new mutations the old-fashioned way and continue to evolve the old-fashioned way, even if some CRISPR-altered people start walking among us.
Okay.
That's my view.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And sometimes in these conversations, I find myself casting a net really, really far out there just to explore what's out there.
It's not that far. That's the thing. It's like these things are things that we ought to be talking about.
Yeah. Well, Carl Zimmer is science columnist for the New York Times. He's author of the new book, She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity. He's going to be talking about his book tonight at the Harvard Bookstore at 7. And by the way, Carl, you should know that Carrie Goldberg, who runs our Common Health section here at WBUR, she's a great science journalist, she said, Carl Zimmer's coming in? The most important science journalist in America? Of course you should have him on. So so you've got fans here in this building.
Awesome.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Last night in Brookline, town meeting members voted to rename a K-8 school, the Edward S. Devotion School, because its namesake was an 18th century slave owner. The change comes as a part of the continuing conversation about how this nation portrays and memorializes, or doesn't, its history of slavery. And that conversation is moving into the art world. Curators at the Worcester Art Museum have installed new permanent signs to tell visitors which people in early American portraits owned enslaved people or benefited from slavery. And WBUR's arts reporter Maria Garcia joins us now with more. Hello, Maria.
Hi, Meghna.
So you've been to the Worcester Art Museum.
I have.
Describe some of these portraits for us.
So they're early American portraits, mostly of the 17th and 18th century. And they're basically portraits that wealthy people commissioned for themselves or for their families. They're meant to convey themes of military prowess and affluence, the power of trade and mercantile exchange. And so these portraits are meant to convey not just appearance, but also the best self of the sitter, right? How they want to remember their legacy.
Monuments to themselves, right?
Right.
So give us an example here.
So there's one portrait of a man named John Boers, and it was painted by John Singleton Copley. Copley, as we know, very well-known painter in colonial America, probably born in Boston, one of the most prominent artistic figures in New England. And he celebrated for not just showing the physicality of his sitters, right, but also conveying their psychological state, their emotional disposition at the time. And so he painted a man named John Boers, and Copley portrayed Boers as a man of sort of quiet intelligence in this very pensive moment. And he's wearing Boers. He's wearing this like lush velvet suit, sitting in this like luxurious mahogany chair. And in the original signage for the portrait, Boers is described as a respected citizen of Newport, Rhode Island.
Ah, interesting. So what's the history then that we're not seeing when we look at this Copley portrait of Boers?
So the new sign informs us that Boers owned an enslaved person named Cato, and that Cato fought in the American Revolution, and that Cato was valued at about 120 pounds at the time. Huh. There's another painting, Meghna, that shows a man named Russell Sturgis. And again, Sturgis is in this very stately pose. He looks very pensive, a man of like deep intellect, right? And there are these cultural signifiers that he's wearing, basically his clothing, elegant stole furs, fine materials. And that's important because in these portraits, the clothing, again, they're cultural signifiers that tell us about a person's wealth, how they made their money, their occupation. And the new sign next to Sturgis's portrait tells us that his family money in part came from a business in Haiti that trafficked in flour, horses, and enslaved people.
Right. So those material, that material wealth or those riches didn't just appear in a vacuum. They have a story and an origin that has to do with enslaved people. Well, what did curators tell you about this new signage and how it's helping viewers better understand both the sitter and the art itself?
Right. So I spoke with the curator, Erin Corrales-Diaz, and here she is speaking about her predecessor who actually installed the signs a few months ago.
She created labels to intervene and to bring attention and a voice to those invisible people behind these sitters.
So again, Meghna, in these early American galleries that are placed in museums all over the country, right? There are galleries like this all over the U.S. We don't see a certain history, mainly the history of people of color, but that's not the only thing that's effaced in these portraits. Also hidden are the ways in which, again, these sitters benefited from slavery, even if they didn't own a slave, because our economy at that time was largely built on black bodies.
Well, so, you know, before signage like this would open the eyes of visitors, I mean, museums were perceived or maybe supposed to be these sort of neutral spaces where you go to enjoy the artistic beauty of the portrait, for example. But when you know that piece of tape that you played from Diaz just a second ago, I mean, the signs are now making the art itself somewhat political, or the Worcester Art Museum into a more political space.
Right. So museum exists within the structural framework of inequality in this country. But I think what has happened for so long is the dominant narrative around cultural institutions has been that because they're the stewards of these cultural artifacts, right, these things, these physical manifestations that represent our shared humanity, that they sort of transcend space and political pressures and societal times, when really they don't. You know, museums operate within systemic biases within our society in the way they collect and in the way they present artifacts. And art, Meghna, really serves to frame history. It forms narratives that can deify people and ignore others. So before these signs were at the Worcester Art Museum, for example, a sitter was portrayed again for intellectual thought, economic success, military powers. But these signs really force us, challenge us to look beyond that and to analyze the sitters in their full complexity and reframe the way we perceive people in early American art.
So to that point, is it doing that at the Worcester Art Museum? I mean, did you talk to visitors who've seen the new signs?
I have. I've spoken to a few people. They said that the signs really forced them to spend more time in the gallery, and they were sort of taken aback by thinking about the accumulation of wealth in the North through black bodies, right, which is not a super dominant narrative in history. And so, yeah, I've spoken to people who say, you know, they were sort of taken aback to right. see these signs suddenly.
Right. On the flip side to that, though, has the Worcester Art Museum had any pushback for the decision that it's made? Mm-hmm.
So the museum has not done an official audience evaluation. I haven't met anyone or heard from anyone who has objected. But I did speak to Elizabeth Athens, who is a curator who originally posted the signs. It was her idea, and she did all the research for it. And she told me that when the signs were first up, she did hear from a couple of people, she said, who sort of made comments, you know, that New England slavery was really different from mm-hmm. Southern slavery, and that context maybe wasn't conveyed in the signs, and that Irish people were treated badly as well. So she heard a couple of comments like that, but she said that was mainly anomalous, and overall it's been positive. Hmm.
Well, we just got a couple seconds here, Maria, but so this is happening at the Worcester Art Museum. Any other institutions doing something like this, sort of giving that additional context to the art that they have?
So there aren't any other institutions that I know of. This kind of signage is not a big trend in the museum world, but there is a precedent for this. In 1992, artist Fred Wilson did a project that changed the way we perceive the museum. It was a seminal project called Mining the Museum. And he did this at the Maryland Historical Society. And he basically went through the society's artifacts that were in storage, stuff that the museum had accumulated but hadn't displayed. And there were a ton of artifacts that were related to slavery that were just in storage. And so he displayed those artifacts next to the actual artifacts that were already on display. So you had slave shackles next to these like beautiful 18th century ornate chairs.
Yeah.
And so that sort of set a precedent for thinking about the museum in these ways.
Well, that's WBUR arts reporter Maria Garcia talking to us about new signage at the Worcester Art Museum, helping viewers get a deeper and more textured understanding of what they're seeing in key pieces of art there. Maria, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Magna.
All right, so we just got a couple minutes left here before the end of the show, but since it is Wednesday, let's do sports with NPR's Only a Game, Bill Littlefield. Hello, Bill.
Hey, Magna.
You got your dream, a 7-game NBA series here with semifinals.
Two of them.
Two of them, that's right. And yet, Boston falls.
Yeah, well, at the beginning of that series, how many people would have thought it would even go 7 games with
you
the Celtics lacking Kyrie Irving? I'm happy that it did, of course. But I think Celtics fans can, with a little bit of context and perspective, can say, hey, you know, that was a heck of a run for a team that probably they couldn't logically, realistically have expected to get that far.
Well, you've said over and over again this season that the Celtics are still a young team.
They are.
So does this bode well for next year then? It's a great experience to have a 7-game semifinal.
Well, part of the fascination of team sports is that so much of the sort of collective mindset of the team is unpredictable. Everything that we know now suggests that the Celtics have a wonderful future ahead of them. Injured players coming back and young players with one more year of experience under their belts who look great. And Brad Stevens isn't going to be any dumber next year than he is this year. He's going to be just as smart and just as sharp and just as pleasant to listen to when he analyzes a game. So there's every reason to think that they'll be very good. And I'm going to stick to that story.
Well, and then so that maybe in that case next year we won't have a Cleveland Golden State final.
Well, LeBron
which we've
James
had for the past four.
Number one, LeBron James will be a year older. And number two, there seems always with LeBron James to be some doubt about where he'll be, whose uniform he'll be wearing.
Oh,
you never know. You never know. He's, you know, Cleveland. Florida, Cleveland again.
Okay, so we should move to the NHL, but I want to ask you one last question. This is in honor of our producer Paris Alston, who when we were talking about Cleveland and Golden State being the final for the fourth year in a row, she rolled her eyes and said, "Boring."
Yeah, I don't buy it. I'm sorry. Okay. You got the two teams that have earned the opportunity to get to the finals. Yes, there is a line of thinking that says Golden State is on paper so much better than Cleveland, and how long can LeBron keep doing these incredible Atlas-like tricks where he carries the rest of the team on his shoulders? These teams have earned the right to be there. two seven-game series that they went through, exhausting series. And I refuse to dismiss this as boring.
All right. Good. Well, let's move on to hockey then. And the Vegas Golden Knights, their first year as a
talk about not boring.
Oh, they're in the Stanley Cup Series against the Capitals, so what do you think?
I think they put on the greatest pregame show ever staged by a hockey team. It's magnificent. It's pure Vegas. The people who run this team understand that if you're going to put a pro sports franchise in Vegas, by gosh, you do a lounge act before it starts.
Well, can we hear a bit from the Stanley Cup opener on Monday?
Conquering enemies on land, sea, and air. The West belongs to Vegas.
A dragon swoops in.
And conquering enemies on ice, too.
Oh my God.
It's fantastic. All of our listeners should see this video. It's absolutely stunning.
Okay. Make it so. Put a link to it at radioboston.org, guys.
It's so great that it causes people to go in and see the show and say, hey, we got a hockey game, too? This is cool.
Phil Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, thank you as always.
My pleasure. Thanks, Magna.
This is Radio Boston.